Certainly it's good to see everyone here this morning. It's good to hear that singing. Yesterday, Debbie and I attended a funeral for one of my cousin's husbands at the United Church of Christ over in Farmersville. They had a couple of old songs that we sing and sing so well. And we commented afterwards, we didn't sing because they had the organ, but I know other people were singing, but you couldn't hear them because the organ drowned them out. And I thought, really, as I reflected upon that, the Lord knew what he was doing, the wonderful exhortation of singing together in song and praising him has so much great value. At our recent quarterly business meeting, it was pointed out that our financial condition of the church continues to decline. The trend began with the pandemic, and we lost people, and has continued up to this current time. And last year, when the budget for 2023 was set, the business meeting approved a deficit budget. We knew that we were spending more money than we currently were taking in. But we did that, and we maintained our commitment to support the preachers that we support in the Philippines and South America and Africa, as well as a couple others here in the United States. And that trend has continued. Well, after the business meeting, one of the members said, you haven't preached on giving in a long time, and said, why don't you preach a sermon on giving? So I actually checked my files. I discovered that the last time I presented a sermon on giving at the West Carrollton Church, I used an overhead projector with slides. I don't know how long we've had the PowerPoint, but it's been a good while. So I don't think I could be accused of hobby writing on the subject of giving and harping on it, because we really haven't talked about it in many, many years. And it's always good to remind us of the Bible teaching about that. So that's what we're going to do this morning. And so we start at the very beginning of the church, and we recognize that at the very beginning of the church, almost immediately, the practice of giving was established. The church was established in Acts 2, preaching of the sermon on the day of Pentecost by the apostles. The one preached by Peter is summarized in Acts chapter 2 for us. And so the church begins, and in Acts 2 verse 44, we read that all those who had believed were together and had all things in common. They began selling their property and possessions and were sharing them with all as anyone might have need. And it can be rightly observed that there were unique circumstances with the establishment of the church that created a very immediate need. We know that 3,000 people were baptized and added to the church on the day of Pentecost. Just a few days later, another 2,000 is recorded as Peter and John preached in the temple. So very quickly, the church went from a handful of Jesus's 12 apostles and the disciples that were with him immediately after his death on the cross to several thousand people. And from the book of Acts, the second chapter, we know that many of these who became Christians were Jews who really lived somewhere else, but who had come to Jerusalem to celebrate the Jewish feast of the Pentecost and had heard the gospel preached and obeyed it. And many of them stayed in Jerusalem longer than they probably had planned on it in order to be taught by the apostles and to be grounded in their new faith. Now, we don't know exactly how long that situation continued. We do know that after the persecution of the church that was led by Saul after the stoning of Stephen, that we are told in Acts 9 that the Christians scattered and went back home. But we don't know exactly how much time passed between the day of Pentecost and that event. But we do know that it continued for at least a little time, and that that became the practice of the church, because we go over a couple chapters into Acts chapter 4 and verse 32, and it says, "The congregation of those who believed were of one heart and soul, and not one of them claimed that anything belonged to him was his own, but all things were common property to them, and with great power of the apostles were giving testimony to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus. And abundant grace was upon them all, for there was not a needy person among them. For all who were owners of land or houses would sell and bring the proceeds of the sales and lay them at the apostles' feet, and they would be distributed to each as they had need. Now Joseph, a Levite of Cyprian birth, who was also called Barnabas by the apostles," which translated means son of encouragement, "who owned a tract of land, sold it and brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet." And so we see that the need of that early church was generally met with a spirit of generosity and a desire of Christians to take care of the needs of one another. It would be unfair to assume that there were no problems, and the Bible doesn't allow us to do that, because Acts chapter 5 deals with the problem with Ananias and Sapphira, who wanted to participate but sold some land, kept part of the money for themselves, and then acted like they were doing like Barnabas and some of the other saints and giving everything that they had received for the sale of their land to this cause. And so we do know that there were some difficulties, at least among some, with their attitudes and with their participation in that. But as we begin to address the development of the responsibility as it's set forth in the New Testament, we want to talk about the fact that giving is just one aspect of the principle of stewardship. And I'm going to look in just a minute at passages that specifically talk about giving, but I want to establish this groundwork first. Giving is just one form of what we call stewardship or service to God. And we look at that, and we look particularly at the parable of the talents in Matthew chapter 25 and verse 14 through 30. And we're not going to read this morning. We think it's probably one of the most familiar of Jesus' teachings. We're going to summarize it. But we want to point out that this isn't a passage about giving. It's a passage about stewardship, about using what God has put into our hands, the opportunities and the means, and putting them to work on his behalf. And so you remember that parable. Jesus talked about a man who's going to go on a journey. And so he called some of his slaves together and he entrusted his possessions to them. But he gave each one of them a different amount based upon probably his evaluation of their ability to do and to use those things. And he gave 5 talents to one, 2 talents to a second, and only 1 talent to a third. And they were told to take care of that for their master. And when he came back, there would be an accounting. And so verse 19 tells us that after a long time, he came back and went to settle the accounts with these servants. And he found that the 5-talent man had put those talents. And back in those days, talent was a sum of money. And so he had put that, which had been entrusted to him, to work, invested it, so forth. And he not only had that 5 talents, but he had an additional 5 talents they earned. He had doubled the master's money. He could give that back to him. And the one to whom he had given the 2 talents did the same with what he had been given and was able to also double that and give it back in 4 talents when the master came back. But then there was the 1-talent man who feared that he would fail and knew that his master was a strict master. And he said, "I was afraid if I took this talent and lost it, that you would be upset with me. So I just put it in the ground and hid it. And now here it is. You've got your 1 talent back." And Jesus says, the master says in verse 26, "You wicked, lazy slave, you knew that's the way that I was. And yet you didn't even put this in the bank and earn interest on it." And he took that 1 talent from him and gave it to the one who had started with 5 and now had 10. And Jesus concludes that parable by saying, "For to everyone who has, more shall be given. and he will have an abundance. But from the one who does not have, even what he does not have will be taken away. Throw out the worthless slave into outer darkness, in that place where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And so what we see here is this is a stewardship question. It is not a matter of how much we have or how much we've been given. It is what do we do with what we have and what we've been given. What do we do for the Lord with those things? Now, our money and our material wealth are simply tools that can be utilized in many ways. We can utilize it to satisfy all of our desires. Or we can use it to take care of our needs and satisfy some of our desires and make sure that we also use some of it in a way that it serves the Lord. And so the question is, what do we do with the resources that we have? The servants in this parable were expected to use what they had with the capabilities that they had to produce fruit for the Lord. And that principle is certainly stated specifically concerning giving when Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 12, "For if the readiness is present, it is acceptable according to what a person has, not according to what he does not have." Paul was talking in that passage, and we'll read some other verses from 2 Corinthians 8 about our giving. And he says, the Lord has an expectation of our service to him, but it's not based upon what we're not capable of doing. He doesn't look at us and say, well, you're not capable of doing what this other person is doing, so I'm displeased with you. He says it's based upon what do you do with what you have. What do you do with the resources and what is available to you? So when we look back again at that early church, we see that there is an obvious need that creates this matter of giving. And the first of those needs is the need of benevolence. The Acts passages we read at the beginning of this lesson certainly centered on Christians pooling their personal funds for the purpose of providing for the physical needs of their fellow members of the Jerusalem church. They saw to it that the basic needs of those members were met in those circumstances. I believe that Christians do that today. I believe they recognize it. It's been a long time now because our daughter, I think, is she 40? I think she's 40. I think when she was 2 years old, our house burned. And by the time the brethren got done with us, we probably had more stuff than we had in the house when it burned to the ground. I think we respond that way very well. And we respond that way not only to our brethren, we respond that way to the world in general. I would be very shocked if there isn't somebody here in the audience that has already contributed to the general needs of the Red Cross for what happened in the disaster in Hawaii. And when we have disasters like that, we help. That's the way we ought to be. The passages that we'll read in just a minute from the book of 1 and 2 Corinthians, which were often talked about when we talk about the subject of giving, were really based upon the need caused by a famine. And the churches in Macedonia gathered money to send to Jerusalem so that the elders of the churches in Jerusalem could provide food for the needy who were affected by that famine. And so benevolence is always a need that we have around. The church here has always had the money available. Sometimes we add to it by letting people know that there's a need and people give additionally. But the benevolent needs have always been met, to my knowledge. The second need is the need for evangelism. And Paul verifies the existence of church funds used for the purpose of providing financial support to those who preach the gospel. In Philippians chapter 4 and verse 15, he says, "You yourselves know, Philippians, that at the first preaching of the gospel, after I left Macedonia, no church shared with me in the matter of giving and receiving, but you alone." That meant they did. "They had funds at Philippi, for even in Thessalonica you sent a gift more than once for my needs." In 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 8, Paul says, "I robbed other churches, taking wages from them in order to preach to you in Corinth." And so we know there is a biblical example of churches having funds and using those funds to assist in the preaching of the gospel. And of course, I think West Carrollton has always done that. We have never had in the time I've been here, a full-time preacher. I guess Brother Hurst was considered a full-time preacher because he had retired as a captain in the Louisville Fire Department and had that pension, and this church supported him, and he spent all of his time preaching. But since I've been here, I had a business. I had a job. And one of the things that the church here has consistently done is spend a good portion of the money that is contributed by the members of this congregation to help missionaries and preachers in other areas. And we support two men in preaching in Africa, one in Romania, one in the Philippines, and until just recently, one in Colombia, South America, who recently has not needed it. Plus, we support a man that works totally on death row in the prisons here in Ohio and has converted death row prisoners to Christ, men who were guilty of terrible things, but he brought the Lord to them. And then we help the church at New Lebanon. We help Brother Hastings preach there because they are about the same size as us and they cannot fully support a preacher. So we have always done that. And as we look at, and I want to be honest with you because this was precipitated by the discussion of our budget, that's not going to stop regardless of what happens, because until the money runs out, we're going to do that type of thing. And we're not in immediate danger of it. But at the same time, the men in October at the business meeting, Brother Gary will present a proposed budget to them, and they will have to look at those things and say, well, based upon what our income is, what are we going to be able to commit to spending in 2024? Well, to continue our thought, people say, well, how and when does the church get these funds that it uses? And we have the examples in the early book of Acts, and also, of course, we know that 1 Corinthians 16, which was talking about the gathering for the benevolence, said, "Now concerning the collection for the saints, as I directed the churches of Galatia, so do you also on the first day of every week let each one of you put aside and save, as he may prosper, so that there be no collections made when I come." And so they gathered that money through a period of time by the free will offering upon the first day of the week. And that is our practice here. We don't try to raise the money using human methods. So you don't find us having fundraisers or bake sales or any of the kind of things that you might see other people in the religious world doing. Let's talk then about the characteristics of faithful giving, because that's really the thing that each of us needs to be thinking about in terms of examining ourselves. And the first thing I would point out is that giving is a planned and purposed action on behalf of the believer. All the Bible tells us about Christians is that we are supposed to give according to our ability. As we just read in 1 Corinthians chapter 16, it's as he may prosper. So it is according to the ability. And the principles of stewardship are ever present. That's why I talked about stewardship before I wanted to talk about these passages. God's expectations on our giving is based upon our capability. 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 12, for the readiness is present, it is acceptable according to what a person has, not according to what he does have. The second thing about it is that that planned and purposed activity has some characteristics involved with it. It's to be done cheerfully, 2 Corinthians 9 and verse 7. Each one must do as he's purposed in his heart, not grudgingly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. And so it is to be something that we are not forced to do or that we do begrudgingly, but it is something that we do willingly with a cheerful heart. Secondly, we could say that it's to be done sacrificially. There's the story of Jesus at the temple in Luke 21, in verse 1, where he says he looked up and saw rich putting their gifts into the treasury. And he saw a poor widow putting in two small copper cones and coins. And he said, "Truly I say to you, this poor widow has put in more than all of them, for they all put out of their surplus, put into the offering, but she out of her poverty put in all that she had to live on." And Jesus' point is that the comparison of the attitudes between the rich and the widow. The rich had a lot to give, and they gave out of their surplus. They made sure all of their needs were met. Then they looked at that contribution. But she gave sacrificially. And it's often true that the poorest among us and those that have the least are the most sacrificial of givers. And so that is something that we all need to keep in mind. What am I sacrificing? If I'm just giving money that I'm not going to use anyway, if I'm just doing those kind of things, what sacrifice have I made on behalf of the Lord? Then the third thing that we are told is that we are to give liberally. 2 Corinthians 8, verses 2 and 3. "Then in the great ordeal of affliction, their abundance of joy and their deep poverty overflowed in the wealth of their liberality." Notice that the wealth wasn't in how much they had. The wealth is in their attitude about what they had. "For I testify that according to their ability and beyond their ability, they gave of their own accord." I think about that because athletics was always important to me. I enjoyed them as a child. I still enjoy watching other people in much better shape than I am do athletic things today. But one of the things that was always stressed as I was growing up is that the athletes who just did what the coach told them to do, well, even if it was shoot 50 free throws before practice starts or at the end, I'm going to make you run wind sprints. But those were never the great athletes. The great athletes, we've got a little girl who plays basketball at Bellbrook that's this way. After practice, they have to run her out of the gym because when everybody else goes home, she stays and shoots for another hour. But you did what the football coach told you to do. But the good football players work all summer lifting weights and doing not what they have to do to meet the minimum, but they do it to excel. And that's what Paul basically says about these people. They go beyond their ability liberally to give. In 2 Corinthians 9 and verse 11, "You will be enriched in everything for all liberality, which through us is producing thanksgiving to God." Brother Bragg made that point in Bible class this morning. That we put God first, we serve Him, God takes care of us. So the question in giving is not as what's the minimum that I need to do, or what am I required to do. You know, I have acquaintances that get a bill from their church that they get told this is what you're expected to do next year. That's not my question. It's not what am I required to do. And it's not our job as a church or even in the business meeting to tell people this is the minimum that we expect of you. That's not the way this is to be done. What our attitude ought to be as a Christian is, what am I capable of doing? And we know from the examples we already read that in times where there were special needs, they managed to do some things that they didn't necessarily have to do before. But because of the special needs, they met the needs because they were capable of meeting the needs. So these principles, cheerful, planned, cheerful, sacrificial, and liberal, apply to every one of us regardless of what our financial condition might be. So as we close, let's just ask the question, well then what would hamper someone's giving? What are the problems connected with giving? And I'm going to suggest that thoughtlessness may indeed be the biggest problem. You know, when Jesus taught us the great parable of the sower and the soils, one of the things that he said is that some seed fell among the thorns, and as it grew up, the thorns choked them out, and they never became fruitful. So many times, the main problem with a Christian's giving is that they just don't take the time to think about it because they are surrounded by the thorns. We need to consider the passages that we have just read and apply them to our own situation. I remember years and years ago when I was a very young preacher preaching in Louisville, Kentucky. The elders went with me because they went to talk to one of the deacons of the church about his giving. And I'd never seen that done before, to be honest with you. And they knew how much he gave because he gave by check, like a lot of us do. That kind of. And I can remember them talking with him, and they didn't say, harshly make demands on him. They just said, we are concerned about you. And you've been active in the church. You've been given a position of responsibility in the church. And yet we know what you give. And I heard him say, it's all that I can afford. I'm just barely making it. And they said to him, this is a nice 3-bedroom house. There's 3 cars in your driveway. There is a camper in your driveway. There is a boat in your driveway. Think about what you can afford versus what you think that you can afford. And I think he was a good, kindly man. And it did get to him. He made some adjustments. And again, that's not telling anybody what they should give. But it brings up the question, what all the things that I just take for granted. I always remember Brother Bragg talking about his business as a jeweler, that I'm not in a needs business, I was in a want business. People get things they want. And we certainly all have those. And I'm not going to say that I don't, because I certainly do. And we have to weigh that with ourselves and say, where am I managing my priorities? Am I thinking all the way through all of this? I think a second problem is that oftentimes giving, and maybe it's the way it's preached about, I'm trying not to preach that way about it today, is it's looked as an obligation rather than as an opportunity. We kind of look at our giving to church the same way we look at paying taxes. I have to pay my taxes. I'm a citizen of the United States. But I work very hard not to give the government a penny more than I really owe them. It's like managing our budget and so many other things. And so, can that sense of that attitude develop about our giving, and we start looking at it as something that we're expected to do, something that God expects us to do, something that the brethren expect us to do, after all the preacher's preaching about it, right? Rather then something I'm doing because I've been saved by a gracious Savior, and He has work for me to do, and He has blessed me, and I love Him, and I love His work, and I love the souls of people that the preachers we support get to call out of the world and save their souls. And that sense of obligation, rather than viewing it as a wonderful opportunity, probably affects those other things we talked about earlier, about how cheerful we will be, how sacrificial we will be, how liberal will we be. Then, we must put it bluntly, sometimes the problem is the sin of covetousness. That wasn't the problem with the church at Corinth, because Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 1, it is superfluous for me to write to you about this ministry to the saints. For I know your readiness, of which I boast about to the Macedonians, namely that Achaia has been prepared since last year, and that your zeal has stirred up most of them. But I have sent the brethren in order that our boasting about you may not be ready, may be made empty in that case, so that as I was saying, you may be prepared. Otherwise, if any Macedonians come with me and find you unprepared, we would not speak of you, but be put to shame by this confidence. So though it is necessary to urge the brethren, and that's really all we're trying to do this morning, is urge brethren, that they go ahead and arrange beforehand their previously promised bountiful gift, so that the same would be ready as a bountiful gift and not affected by covetousness. Now this I say, he who sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, and he who sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. He says, don't let covetousness get in the way, but be bountiful with your gift. The world will always find plenty of things about which to make demands upon our financial resources. This week I had to pay because we got moles in our yard. Get those moles removed. And I do that because I love my wife, because those moles affect her flowers. And I wouldn't know what to do if she was in the house under my foot all day. So I'm glad she's out there in her garden with her flowers and shares that beauty with everybody else. But nowhere in my August budget did I have moles. They just happened, right? And that's the way life happens. A doctor visit happens. A car breaks down. And those are the realities of life. But the comfort of all that is God only expects us to do what we are able to do. The thing we have to be careful is not to let covetous needs get in the way. And so each one of us needs to examine ourselves, and our hope is that this lesson will exhort and encourage all of us to consider this as we approach our own planning for the next year. And we're not making, and I don't want this to be misguided, we're not making any threats that if the contribution doesn't go up, certain things are going to be cut. We've made provisions for that and that type of thing. But encourage people to think about it. Because obviously, we will do what we have the capability of doing as a church. And that time of planning for our next year is coming. So I hope everybody takes that in the spirit in which it's been offered. We all must make those considerations from time to time. And I'm convinced that we all think about those things. And so this is just to encourage us to think about those things just a little bit more. So bringing the lesson to a close, we're going to extend the invitation. And we recognize that a lot of lessons are directed to the members of the church rather than to anybody that might need to obey the gospel. And this certainly has been the case, because that's who's responsible for the collection to the saints, is the saints. But if there's one in the audience this morning who has been contemplating obeying the gospel, recognizes that that need can only be met in Jesus Christ, and you're willing to confess your faith in Christ and be baptized in his name, we would invite you to do so. Everything is ready to assist you to do that. We invite you to come while we stand and while we sing.